Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Every Thursday night, we turn back the clock and speak to someone who was there when history was made in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And tonight, we're going back nearly 30 years to look at the last major eruption of Aotearoa's largest volcano, Mount Ruapehu. Between 1995 and 96, the mountain, well, put on a show, really. It threw ash and rocks and water across the surrounding area. And someone who spent their life studying the volcano and who was indeed there in 1995 and 1996 is GNS volcanologist Brad Scott, who's on the line now. Kia ora to you, Brad.
Kia ora, good afternoon.
Is Ruapehu an especially active or dangerous volcano? It had numerous eruptions throughout the 20th century, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. Just stepping back one notch, in New Zealand, we had three primary types of volcanoes. Our volcanic fields is one, and Auckland's our best example. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of small volcanoes spread out. A real challenge because we don't know where the next volcano will be or next eruption. Our volcanic cones, and this is where Ruapehu fits in, Narahoe, Taranaki, and the likes, Whakaari. Also as a cone, these volcanoes are frequently active. So in our lifetime, we will see multiple eruptions from those volcanoes. And our third type of volcano is the ones that the media and people like to call super volcanoes, and those are our caldera volcanoes. They don't erupt very often.
Which is good.
Hundreds of thousands, maybe.
Yeah, we'd be in a bit of trouble if one of them erupted.
Yeah, they're certainly devastating. So they have eruptions, hundreds to thousands of years apart, and are very, very big. So coming back to Ruapehu, it's a frequently active volcano. It was particularly active in the 40s. It was quiet for 15 or so years after that, through to mid-1960s. And then a prolonged eruptive episode from the mid-60s that basically... The climax was 1995-96. So we had lots of small eruptions. We had lots of molten material associated with the volcano, over 20 plus years, and ultimately the 95-96 eruption episode.
What causes volcanic eruptions?
The short answer is just overpressure. Pressure builds up inside the volcano. The definition of an eruption is basically a rock being ejected out of a hole in the ground and flying through the air.
Right. scientific.
That's the simplest sort of scientific. what's going to toss a rock out? Well, it's got to have some pressure behind it to toss it. That pressure can be driven by the geothermal or hydrothermal system. It can be driven by what we call the magmatic system. That's the hot molten rock, the magma. Gases coming from the magma. There's several mechanisms, but it basically you've got to overpressure things.
And in this case, the 1995-96 eruptions, am I right in saying that earthquakes were a contributing factor here?
It's a yes and no answer, sorry.
Right. No, that's good. We like yes or no answers. Yeah. Strategic ambiguity.
In the big picture, New Zealand has an earthquake problem because we live on a plate boundary. But also the processes associated with the volcano create earthquakes. And in its simplest form, an earthquake is a rock breaking. If you bend a rock like you bend a plastic ruler or a piece of timber, if you bend it too far, it snaps. And that's exactly what happens to the crust of the earth or the rocks. You apply pressure, apply a force, they get bent, ultimately they break. So our big regional earthquakes, they're generated by the plates bending New Zealand, deformation across the plate boundary, the molten material in the volcano and the geothermal systems. They also apply pressure and they bend the rocks in the volcano and also generate earthquakes. Those earthquakes are reflective of processes happening in the volcano, and that's where we study earthquakes associated with volcanoes, because that's starting to give us a window into what's happening under the volcano.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's all interconnected. All right, so take us back to 1995. There was a series of major eruptions. Was there a sense beforehand that something was going to happen? Did you have early alert systems in place, and did you know that something was brewing down there?
The short answer is no. We were all taken quite by surprise by the magnitude of the eruptive episode. On the other side of the coin, we knew that Ruapehu was in a state of volcanic unrest. There had been changes back to June. In June there was eruptions and activity happening in the volcano. The chemistry of the crater lake was changing. We had seen those changes before, especially in the 1970s. So it was different. It was unusual. There was volcanic unrest, but the unrest, wasn't screaming out saying, "Hey, I'm going to be the biggest eruption in 50 years."
Yeah. When it did actually happen, what was your instant reaction? Were you worried, or were you more sort of excited? Because I imagine news like this for a volcanologist would be actually quite exciting.
From a career perspective and professionally, it's extremely exciting. The other factor about Ruapehu, though, is it's incredibly well mitigated. We'd had eruptions, particularly the 1969 eruption and 1974 eruptions. Those eruptions had demonstrated, where the dangers were on the volcano, what the Laha paths were, and work with RAL and Lands and Survey come DOC through that time. All of the infrastructure was moved out of the valleys, and the volcano had actually been made really quite safe by that sort of mitigation work. The kiosks, they got damaged in both the 69 and 74 eruption. That building was demolished and moved up onto a ridge. You didn't have people going to a building that was in the floor of a valley. The pylons that hold up the ski toes, they were moved out of the valleys. The ends of the ski toe, they were moved up onto the ridges. So that made it actually relatively safe. Yes, it's an active volcano and there are hazards, but a hell of a lot of mitigation had been done. So, one's immediate response wasn't, "Oh my God, how many people?" Because you knew that the place was safe, and also the timing. The September 16 eruption, was after the ski field had closed. So people were off the ski, well, mostly off the ski fields, back at the ski lodges. The ski lodges are, by far the best place to be on Ruapehu. They're incredibly safe locations. And from the responding agencies, civil defence, DOC, police, etc., actually having the people in the ski lodges is by far the easiest way to manage them.
Yeah, I imagine it's still pretty scary being in the ski lodges. Now, of course, that September 16 eruption was not the last of the big ones. There was another in 1996, and this happened during the ski season, and there were indeed people on the mountain. That would have been a bit more scary from your point of view, I imagine.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't appreciate is actually, the largest part of the 1995 eruptions, it started off on the Monday. I can't remember the date now. There was eruptions on Monday that produced significant lahars, but it was a raining, wet day. We were up on the volcano on the Wednesday doing deformation survey sampling the crater lake, and then that September 16 eruption was on the Saturday afternoon or evening. But it wasn't until between the 7th and 14th of October that the largest eruptions occurred. This is in 1995. And they deposited ash, or the first one deposited ash down to Akitio, down in the South Wairarapa.
Yeah.
And the second one was across towards Gisborne and up to the East Cape. Both of those eruptions were, you know, several times bigger than the one that everybody saw on September 16, but they occurred in the middle of the night, and nobody, you know, nobody observed them, so we didn't have a feeling for the scale of them, just right. how big they were.
Yeah, I see.
And then, as you say, the volcano went quiet late October, early November, and then reawakened in June. And the reawakening eruption was pretty spectacular. That created an ash fall, you know, from the volcano through Lake Taupo, Rotorua, Te Puke, and out to sea.
Yeah, and it was quite scary after that 96 eruption, wasn't it? And that that the crater lake burst through some kind of ash dam, didn't it? And we were kind of like, oh, gee, we've really got to sort this out, otherwise a big eruption in the future could be pretty catastrophic.
That was probably, that wasn't just several years later, but winding the clock back, you know, what lessons have we learnt from volcanoes and volcanic eruptions, and what have we learnt from Ruapehu? And the big lesson from Ruapehu was the Tangiwai disaster of 1953.
Right, yeah.
What people realised when they looked back was that the 1945 eruption had created an artificial dam, and when the new crater lake was created after 1945 in the early 50s, that dam failed in 1953, and that's what generated the Tangiwai disaster. And what we realised very quickly during 95 and during 96 was that a dam had also been formed by the 95 and 96 eruptions, and yes, that would fail, you know, in a decade or so's time, and that generated a whole other story. You know, how do you manage those sort of hazards?
Yeah.
Do you buy a bulldozer and bulldoze the dam away, or do you, you know, let nature take its course and take other mitigation? And as I say, that's a whole story in its own.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, how that was dealt with a decade after.
A whole other conversation, I think. Maybe we'll have it one day. Yeah. Hey, Brad, just finally on this, what did we learn from that period scientifically? Like, what was your... What did you look at? What did you study? How did you use these eruptions, I suppose, to further our knowledge and understanding of the volcano and volcanology in New Zealand more broadly?
Yeah, there were three or four, you know, lessons that came out of Ruapehu. One we've touched on, the dam break, the earth dam that gets built by an eruption and when you have a new crater lake. I think the two big areas were in communications. Everybody was running around trying to learn what is volcanic ash, what is the implication of volcanic ash, what does it mean for us? And, you know, then that questions were being asked in health and agriculture and things like that. You know, what does volcanic ash mean to us? And for us, we were caught on the back foot. We all knew about volcanic ash, but we didn't have material prepared to pass on to external agencies. And we also realised that some of the questions being asked, we didn't actually know, you know, like just how thick can ash be before it collapses a New Zealand roof.
Right.
You know, we know how thick it is in Indonesia to collapse a grass hut.
Yeah.
But we didn't really know with respect to New Zealand building code and things like that. So we've had a whole pile of students working on creating fragility indices on things like roofs and roads and airports and sewage systems, freshwater systems. So that was a big lesson, you know, just, and from that we've created a web page environment that is hosted by the Americans, and it's a global one-stop shop for volcanic ash impacts. So everybody researching volcanic ash puts their research into that one website, and when anybody in the globe has an eruption, they can go there and get the the best information on, you know, what does it mean for my generator? What does it mean for my tractor? What does it mean for my airport or my sewerage system, et cetera? And in parallel with that was the health sector.
Yeah.
A lot of questions coming out of health. At the end of the day, volcanic ash is a nuisance. Mm. It's not a large health threat, but the only people that can be impacted is somebody with a predisposition, like an asthmatic or something like that. Mm-hmm. Again, we weren't prepared. We didn't have the material bundled up and packaged in the web page environment to share with those agencies. So yeah, there was some, you know, quite interesting lessons. And the fourth one was a thing called remobilization. Mm-hmm. When it rains weeks, months, even years after an eruption, the material that's been erupted can get washed off the volcano and cause secondary floods and secondary lahars. Mm. And the, you know, a big lesson was learned in the Tongariro Power Scheme. That was destroyed or significantly damaged, you know, several weeks after the eruptions had finished. The eruptions had finished in late October and it got taken out in November of 95 just by a rainfall event.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Brad Scott, thanks so much for joining the program this evening and taking us through it. It's really interesting stuff.
Okay, yeah, thanks for the opportunity to relive it and remember some of it. It's been interesting.
And that was Brad Scott. Brad is a volcanologist with GNS.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.